From The Future of an Illusion, translated and edited by James Strachey. Sigmund Freud. Richard Wolheim once described Sigmund Freud's work as an essay in the deafness of the mind, and whatever we may now think about the father of modern psychology, it is impossible not to regard his insights into the unconscious as seminal and revolutionary. Fascinated by totem and taboo, and by the manacles that the mind forges for itself, Freud here subjects religious belief to a calm and even quite sympathetic, if pitying, diagnosis. I think we have prepared the way sufficiently for an answer to both these questions. It will be found if we turn our attention to the psychical origin of religious ideas. These, which are given out as teachings, are not precipitates of experience or end results of thinking. They are illusions, fulfillments of the oldest, strongest, and most urgent wishes of mankind. The secret of their strength lies in the strength of those wishes. As we already know, the terrifying impression of helplessness in childhood aroused the need for protection through love, which was provided by the father, and the recognition that this helplessness lasts throughout life made it necessary to cling to the existence of a father, but this time a more powerful one. Thus the benevolent rule of a divine providence allays our fear of the dangers of life. The establishment of a moral world order ensures the fulfillment of the demands of justice, which have so often remained unfulfilled in human civilization, and the prolongation of earthly existence in a future life provides the local and temporal framework in which these wish fulfillments shall take place. Answers to the riddles that tempt the curiosity of man, such as how the universe began, or what the relation is between body and mind, are developed in conformity with the underlying assumptions of this system. It is an enormous relief to the individual psyche if the conflicts of its childhood arising from the father complex, conflicts which it has never wholly overcome, are removed from it and brought to a solution which is universally accepted. When I say that these things are all illusions, I must define the meaning of the word. An illusion is not the same thing as an error, nor is it necessarily an error. Aristotle's belief that vermin are developed out of dung, a belief to which ignorant people still cling, was an error. So was the belief of a former generation of doctors that the tabes dorsalis is the result of sexual excess. It would be incorrect to call these errors illusions. On the other hand, it was an illusion of Columbus's that he had discovered a new sea route to the Indies. The part played by his wish in this error is very clear. One may describe as an illusion the assertion made by certain nationalists that the Indo-Germanic race is the only one capable of civilization, or the belief, which was only destroyed by psychoanalysis, that children are creatures without sexuality. What is characteristic of illusions is that they are derived from human wishes. In this respect, they come near to psychiatric delusions. But they differ from them, too, apart from the more complicated structure of delusions. In the case of delusions, we emphasize as essential their being in contradiction with reality. Illusions need not necessarily be false, that is to say, unrealizable, or in contradiction to reality. For instance, a middle-class girl may have the illusion that a prince will come and marry her. This is possible, and a few such cases have occurred. That the Messiah will come and found a golden age is much less likely. Whether one classifies this belief as an illusion or as something analogous to a delusion will depend on one's personal attitude. Examples of illusions which have proved true are not easy to find, but the illusion of the alchemists that all metals can be turned into gold might be one of them. The wish to have a great deal of gold, as much gold as possible, has, it is true, been a good deal damped by our present-day knowledge of the determinants of wealth. But chemistry no longer regards the transmutation of metals into gold as impossible. Thus, we call a belief an illusion when a wish fulfillment is a prominent factor in its motivation, and in doing so we disregard its relations to reality, just as the illusion itself sets no store by verification. Having thus taken our bearings, let us return once more to the question of religious doctrines. We can now repeat that all of them are illusions and insusceptible of proof. No one can be compelled to think them true, to believe in them. Some of them are so improbable, so incompatible with everything we have laboriously discovered about the reality of the world, that we may compare them, if we pay proper regard, to the psychological differences, to delusions. Of the reality value of most of them, we cannot judge, just as they cannot be proved, so they cannot be refuted. We still know too little to make a critical approach to them. The riddles of the universe reveal themselves only slowly to our investigation. There are many questions to which science today can give no answer. But scientific work is the only road which can lead us to a knowledge of reality outside ourselves. It is once again merely an illusion to expect anything from intuition and introspection. They can give us nothing but particulars about our own mental life, which are hard to interpret. Never any information about the questions which religious doctrine finds it so easy to answer. It would be insolent to let one's own arbitrary will step into the breach and, according to one's personal estimate, declare this or that part of the religious system to be less or more acceptable. Such questions are too momentous for that. They might be called too sacred. At this point, one must expect to meet with an objection. Well then, if even obdurate skeptics admit that the assertions of religion cannot be refuted by reason, why should I not believe in them, since they have so much on their side, tradition, the agreement of mankind, and all the consolations they offer? Why not indeed? Just as no one can be forced to believe, so no one can be forced to disbelieve. But do not let us be satisfied with deceiving ourselves that arguments like these take us along the road of correct thinking. If ever there was a case of a lame excuse, we have it here. Ignorance is ignorance. No right to believe anything can be derived from it. In other matters, no sensible person will behave so irresponsibly or rest content with such feeble grounds for his opinions and for the line he takes. It is only in the highest and most sacred things that he allows himself to do so. In reality, these are only attempts at pretending to oneself or to other people that one is still firmly attached to religion, when one has long since cut oneself loose from it. Where questions of religion are concerned, people are guilty of every possible sort of dishonesty and intellectual misdemeanor. Philosophers stretch the meaning of words until they retain scarcely anything of their original sense. They give the name of God to some vague abstraction which they have created for themselves. Having done so, they can pose before all the world as deists, as believers in God. And they can even boast that they have recognized a higher, purer concept of God, notwithstanding that their God is now nothing more than an insubstantial shadow and no longer the mighty personality of religious doctrines. Critics persist in describing as deeply religious anyone who admits to a sense of man's insignificance or impotence in the face of the universe, although what constitutes the essence of the religious attitude is not this feeling, but only the next step after it, the reaction to it which seeks a remedy for it. The man who goes no further but humbly acquiesces in the small part which human beings play in the great world, such a man is, on the contrary, irreligious in the truest sense of the word. To assess the truth value of religious doctrines does not lie within the scope of the present inquiry. It is enough for us that we have recognized them as being, in their psychological nature, illusions. But we do not have to conceal the fact that this discovery also strongly influences our attitude to the question which must appear, to many, to be the most important of all. We know approximately at what periods and by what kind of men religious doctrines were created. If, in addition, we discover the motives which led to this, our attitude to the problem of religion will undergo a marked displacement. We shall tell ourselves that it would be very nice if there were a God who created the world and was a benevolent providence. and if there was a moral order in the universe and an afterlife. But it is a very striking fact that all this is exactly as we are bound to wish it to be. And it would be more remarkable still if our wretched, ignorant, and downtrodden ancestors had succeeded in solving all these difficult riddles of the universe. Having recognized religious doctrines as illusions, we are at once faced by a further question. May not other cultural assets of which we hold a high opinion and by which we let our lives be ruled be of a similar nature? Must not the assumptions that determine our political regulations be called illusions as well? And is it not the case that in our civilization the relations between the sexes are disturbed by an erotic illusion or a number of such illusions? At once our suspicion has been aroused. We shall not shrink from asking, too, whether our conviction that we can learn something about external reality through the use of observation and reasoning in scientific work, whether this conviction has any better foundation. Nothing ought to keep us from directing our observation to our own selves, or from applying our thought to criticism of itself. In this field, a number of investigations open out before us, whose results could not be decisive for the construction of a Weltanschauung. We surmise, moreover, that such an effort would not be wasted, and that it would at least in part justify our suspicion. But the author does not dispose of the means for undertaking so comprehensive a task. He needs must confine his work to following out one only of these illusions, that, namely, of religion. But now the loud voice of our opponent brings us to a halt. We are called to account for our wrongdoing. Archaeological interests are no doubt most praiseworthy, but no one undertakes an excavation if by doing so he is going to undermine the habitations of the living so that they collapse and bury people under their ruins. The doctrines of religion are not a subject one can quibble about like any other. Our civilization is built upon them, and the maintenance of human society is based on the majority of men's believing in the truth of those doctrines. If men are taught that there is no almighty and all-just God, no divine world order and no future life, they will feel exempt from all obligation to obey the precepts of civilization. Everyone will, without inhibition or fear, follow his asocial, egoistic instincts and seek to exercise his power. Chaos, which we have banished through many thousands of years of the work of civilization, will come again. Even if we knew and could prove that religion was not in possession of the truth, we ought to conceal the fact and behave in the way prescribed by the philosophy of as if, and this in the interest of the preservation of us all. And apart from the danger of the undertaking, it would be a purposeless cruelty. Countless people find their one consolation in religious doctrines, and can only bear life with their help. You would rob them of their support, without having anything better to give them in exchange. It is admitted that so far science has not achieved much, but even if it had advanced much further, it would not suffice for man. Man has imperative needs of another sort, which can never be satisfied by cold science. And it is very strange indeed. It is the height of inconsistency that a psychologist, who has always insisted on what a minor part is played in human affairs by the intelligence as compared with the life of the instincts, that such a psychologist should now try to rob mankind of a precious wish fulfillment and should propose to compensate them for it with intellectual nourishment. What a lot of accusations all at once! Nevertheless, I am ready with rebuttals for them all, and what is more, I shall assert the view that civilization runs a greater risk if we maintain our present attitude to religion than if we give it up. But I hardly know where to begin my reply. Perhaps with the assurance that I myself regard my undertaking as completely harmless and free of risk. It is not I who am overvaluing the intellect this time. If people are as my opponents describe them, and I should not like to contradict them, then there is no danger of a devout believer's being overcome by my arguments and deprived of his faith. Besides, I have said nothing which other and better men have not said before me, in a much more complete, forcible, and impressive manner. Their names are well known, and I shall not cite them, for I should not like to give an impression that I am seeking to rank myself as one of them. All I have done, and this is the only thing that is new in my exposition, is to add some psychological foundation to the criticisms of my great predecessors. It is hardly to be expected that precisely this addition will produce the effect which was denied to those earlier efforts. No doubt, I might be asked here, what is the point of writing these things if I am certain that they will be ineffective? But I shall come back to that later. The one person this publication may injure is myself. I shall have to listen to the most disagreeable reproaches for my shallowness, narrow-mindedness, and lack of idealism or of understanding for the highest interests of mankind. But on the one hand, such remonstrances are not new to me, and on the other, if a man has already learnt in his youth to rise superior to the disapproval of his contemporaries, what can it matter to him, in his old age, when he is certain soon to be beyond the reach of all favour or disfavour? In former times, it was different. Then utterances such as mine brought with them a sure curtailment of one's earthly existence, and an effective speeding up of the opportunity for gaining a personal experience of the afterlife. But I repeat, those times are past, and today writings such as this bring no more danger to their author than to their readers. The most that can happen is that the translation and distribution of his book will be forbidden in one country or another, and precisely, of course, in a country that is convinced of the high standard of its culture. But if one puts in any plea at all for the renunciation of wishes and for acquiescence in fate, one must be able to tolerate this kind of injury too. The further question occurred to me whether the publication of this work might not, after all, do harm. Not to a person, however, but to a cause. The cause of psychoanalysis. For it cannot be denied that psychoanalysis is my creation, and it has met with plenty of mistrust and ill will. If I now come forward with such displeasing pronouncements, people will be only too ready to make a displacement from my person to psychoanalysis. Now we see, they will say, where psychoanalysis leads to. The mask has fallen. It leads to a denial of God and of a moral idea, as we always suspected. To keep us from this discovery, we have been deluded into thinking that psychoanalysis has no Weltanschauung and never can construct one. An outcry of this kind will really be disagreeable to me on account of my many fellow workers, some of whom do not by any means share my attitude to the problems of religion. But psychoanalysis has already weathered many storms, and now it must brave this fresh one. In point of fact, psychoanalysis is a method of research, an impartial instrument, like the infinitesimal calculus, as it were. If a physicist were to discover, with the latter's help, that after a certain time the Earth would be destroyed, we would nevertheless hesitate to attribute destructive tendencies to the calculus itself, and therefore to prescribe it. Nothing that I have said here against the truth value of religions needed the support of psychoanalysis. It had been said by others long before analysis came into existence. If the application of the psychoanalytic method makes it possible to find a new argument against the truths of religion, tant pis for religion. But to defenders of religion, will by the same right make use of psychoanalysis in order to give full value to the effective significance of religious doctrines. And now to proceed with our defense. Religion has clearly performed great services for human civilization. It has contributed much towards the taming of the asocial instincts, but not enough. It has ruled human society for many thousands of years and has had time to show what it can achieve. If it had succeeded in making the majority of mankind happy, in comforting them, in reconciling them to life and in making them into vehicles of civilization, no one would dream of attempting to alter the existing conditions. But what do we see instead? We see that an appallingly large number of people are dissatisfied with civilization and unhappy in it, and feel it as a yoke which must be shaken off, and that these people either do everything in their power to change that civilization or else go so far in their hostility to it that they will have nothing to do with civilization or with a restriction of instinct. At this point, it will be objected against us that this state of affairs is due to the very fact that religion has lost a part of its influence over human masses, precisely because of the deplorable effect of the advances of science. We will note this admission and the reason given for it, and we shall make use of it later for our own purposes. But the objection itself has no force. It is doubtful whether men were in general happier at a time when religious doctrines held unrestricted sway. More moral they certainly were not. They have always known how to externalize the precepts of religion and thus to nullify their intentions. The priests, whose duty it was to ensure obedience to religion, met them halfway in this. God's kindness must lay a restraining hand on his justice. One sinned, and then one made a sacrifice or did penance, and then one was free to sin once more. Russian introspectiveness has reached the pitch of concluding that sin is indispensable for the enjoyment of all the blessings of divine grace, so that, at bottom, sin is pleasing to God. It is no secret that the priests could only keep the masses submissive to religion by making such large concessions as these to the instinctual nature of man. Thus it was agreed, God alone is strong and good, man is weak and sinful. In every age, immorality has found no less support in religion than morality has. If the achievements of religion in respect to man's happiness, susceptibility to culture, and moral control are no better than this, the question cannot but arise whether we are not overrating its necessity for mankind, and whether we do wisely in basing our cultural demands upon it. Let us consider the unmistakable situation as it is today. We have heard the admission that religion no longer has the same influence on people that it used to. We are here concerned with European Christian civilization. And this is not because its promises have grown less, but because people find them less credible. Let us admit that the reason, though perhaps not the only reason, for this change is the increase of the scientific spirit in the higher strata of human society. Criticism has whittled away the evidential value of religious documents. Natural science has shown up the errors in them, and comparative research has been struck by the fatal resemblance between the religious ideas which we revere, and the mental products of primitive peoples and times. The scientific spirit brings about a particular attitude towards worldly matters. Before religious matters, it pauses for a little, hesitates, and finally thereto crosses the threshold. In this process there is no stopping. The greater the number of men to whom the treasures of knowledge become accessible, the more widespread is the falling away from religious belief. At first only from its obsolete and objectionable trappings, but later from its fundamental postulates as well. The Americans, who instituted the monkey trial at Dayton, have alone shown themselves consistent. Elsewhere, the inevitable transition is accomplished by way of half-measures and insincerities. Civilization has little to fear from educated people and brain workers. In them, the replacement of religious motives for civilized behavior by other, secular motives would proceed unobtrusively. Moreover, such people are to a large extent themselves vehicles of civilization. But it is another matter with the great mass of the uneducated and oppressed, who have every reason for being enemies of civilization. So long as they do not discover that people no longer believe in God, all is well. But they will discover it, infallibly, even if this piece of writing of mine is not published. And they are ready to accept the results of scientific thinking, but without the change having taken place in them, which scientific thinking brings about in people. Is there not a danger here that the hostility of these masses to civilization will throw itself against the weak spot that they have found in their taskmistress? If the sole reason why you must not kill your neighbor is because God has forbidden it, and will severely punish you for it in this or the next life, then when you learn that there is no God, and that you need not fear his punishment, you will certainly kill your neighbor without hesitation, and you can only be prevented from doing so by mundane force. Thus, Either these dangerous masses must be held down most severely and kept most carefully away from any chance of intellectual awakening, or else the relationship between civilization and religion must undergo a fundamental revision. Selected Writings on Religion, Albert Einstein. Another master of the modern world, to whom we owe an enormously expanded idea of the nature of the universe, Albert Einstein, 1879 to 1955, was a great humanist and humanitarian. His opinion on religious matters was eagerly sought because it seemed, to many people, that his own intelligence was almost godlike. Declining such idolatry, Einstein always insisted that the miraculous thing about the natural order was that there were no miracles, and that it operated according to astonishing regularities. This placed him firmly in the tradition of Spinoza in repudiating the notion of a god who took an interest in human affairs. The following excerpts from his frequent commentary on religious matters should suffice to answer those, most notably his most recent biographer, Walter Isaacson, who attempt to conscript him posthumously into the camp of belief. "It was, of course, a lie what you read about my religious convictions, a lie which is being systematically repeated. I do not believe in a personal God, and I have never denied this, but have expressed it clearly. If something is in me which can be called religious, then it is the unbounded admiration for the structure of the world so far as our science can reveal it." Albert Einstein, in a letter, March 24, 1954, from Albert Einstein, The Human Side, Helen Dukas and Banesh Hoffman, editors, Princeton, New Jersey, Princeton University Press, 1981, page 43. "When I was a fairly precocious young man, I became thoroughly impressed with the futility of the hopes and strivings that chase most men relentlessly through life. Moreover, I soon discovered the cruelty of that chase, which in those years was much more carefully covered up by hypocrisy and glittering words than is the case today. By the mere existence of his stomach, everyone was condemned to participate in that chase. The stomach might well be satisfied by such participation, but not man insofar as he is a thinking and feeling being. As the first way out, there was religion, which is implanted into every child by way of the traditional education machine. Thus I came, though the child of entirely irreligious Jewish parents, to a deep religiousness, which, however, reached an abrupt end at the age of 12. Through the reading of popular scientific books, I soon reached the conviction that much in the stories of the Bible could not be true. The consequence was a positive, fanatic orgy of free-thinking coupled with the impression that youth is intentionally being deceived by the state through lies. It was a crushing impression. Mistrust of every kind of authority grew out of this experience. The skeptical attitude towards the convictions that were alive in any specific social environment, an attitude that has never again left me, even though, later on, it has been tempered by a better insight into the casual connections. It is quite clear to me that the religious paradise of youth, which was thus lost, was a first attempt to free myself from the chains of the merely personal, from an existence dominated by wishes, hopes, and primitive feelings. Out yonder, there was this huge world, which exists independently of us human beings, and which stands before us like a great, eternal riddle, at least partially accessible to our inspection and thinking. The contemplation of this world beckoned as a liberation, and I soon noticed that many a man whom I had learned to esteem and to admire had found inner freedom and security in its pursuit. The mental grasp of this extra-personal world within the frame of our capabilities presented itself to my mind, half-consciously, half-unconsciously, as a supreme goal. Similarly, motivated men of the present and of the past, as well as the insights they had achieved, were the friends who could not be lost. The road to this paradise was not as comfortable and alluring as the road to the religious paradise, but it has shown itself reliable, and I have never regretted having chosen it." Albert Einstein, Autobiographical Notes, Chicago, Illinois, Open Court Publishing Company, 1979, pages 3-5. "My position concerning God is that of an agnostic, I am convinced that a vivid consciousness of the primary importance of moral principles for the betterment and ennoblement of life does not need the idea of a lawgiver, especially a lawgiver who works on the basis of reward and punishment. Albert Einstein, in a letter to M. Berkowitz, October 25, 1950, Einstein Archive 59-215, from Alice Calaprice, editor, The Expanded Quotable Einstein, Princeton, New Jersey, Princeton University Press, 2000, page 216. The fairest thing we can experience is the mysterious. It is the fundamental emotion which stands at the cradle of true art and true science. He who knows it not, and can no longer wonder, no longer feel amazement, is as good as dead, a snuffed-out candle. It was the experience of mystery, even if mixed with fear, that engendered religion. A knowledge of the existence of something we cannot penetrate, of the manifestations of the profoundest reason and the most radiant beauty, which are only accessible to our reason in their most elementary forms. It is this knowledge and this emotion that constitute the truly religious attitude. In this sense, and in this alone, I am a deeply religious man. I cannot conceive of a God who rewards and punishes his creatures, or has a will of the type of which we are conscious in ourselves. An individual who should survive his physical death is also beyond my comprehension. Nor do I wish it otherwise. Such notions are for the fears or absurd egoism of feeble souls. Enough for me the mystery of the eternity of life, and the inkling of the marvelous structure of reality, together with the single-hearted endeavor to comprehend a portion, be it never so tiny, of the reason that manifests itself in nature. Albert Einstein, The World as I See It, Secaucus, New Jersey, The Citadel Press, 1999, page 5. The idea of a personal God is quite alien to me, and seems even naive. Albert Einstein, in a letter to Beatrice Froelich, December 17, 1952, Einstein Archive, 59-797, from The Expanded Quotable Einstein, page 217. It seems to me that the idea of a personal God is an anthropological concept which I cannot take seriously. I feel also not able to imagine some will or goal outside the human sphere. My views are near those of Spinoza. Admiration for the beauty of and belief in the logical simplicity of the order which we can grasp humbly and only imperfectly. I believe that we have to content ourselves with our imperfect knowledge and understanding and treat values and moral obligations as a purely human problem. The most important of all human problems. Albert Einstein, 1947, from Banesh Hoffman. Albert Einstein, Creator and Rebel, New York, New American Library, 1972, page 95. I am a deeply religious non-believer. This is a somewhat new kind of religion. Albert Einstein, in a letter to Hans Mürsam, March 30, 1954. Einstein Archive, 38-434, from The Expanded Quotable Einstein, page 218. I believe in Spinoza's God who reveals himself in the orderly harmony of what exists, not in a God who concerns himself with fates and actions of human beings. Albert Einstein, upon being asked if he believed in God by Rabbi Herbert Goldstein of the Institutional Synagogue, New York, April 24, 1921. Published in the New York Times, April 25, 1929. From Einstein, The Life and Times, Ronald W. Clark, New York, World Publishing Company, 1971, page 413. Also cited as a telegram to a Jewish newspaper, 1929. Einstein Archive, 33-272. From The Expanded Quotable Einstein, page 204. I do not believe in immortality of the individual, and I consider ethics to be an exclusively human concern with no superhuman authority behind it. Albert Einstein, Letter to a Baptist Pastor, in 1953, from Albert Einstein, The Human Side, page 39. Why do you write to me, God should punish the English? I have no close connection to either one or the other, I see only with deep regret that God punishes so many of his children for their numerous stupidities, for which only he himself can be held responsible. In my opinion, only his non-existence could excuse him. Albert Einstein. Letter to Edgar Meyer, a Swiss colleague, January 2, 1915, from the expanded quotable Einstein, page 201. It is quite possible that we can do greater things than Jesus, for what is written in the Bible about him is poetically embellished. Albert Einstein quoted in W.I. Herman's A Talk with Einstein, October 1943, Einstein Archive, 55-285. From the expanded quotable Einstein, page 215. I cannot imagine a God who rewards and punishes the objects of his creation, whose purposes are modelled after our own, a God, in short, who is but a reflection of human frailty. Neither can I believe that the individual survives the death of his body, although feeble souls harbour such thoughts through fear or ridiculous egotisms. Albert Einstein quoted in the New York Times obituary, April 19, 1955, from George Seldes, editor, The Great Thoughts, New York, Valentine Books, 1996, page 134. The most important human endeavour is the striving for morality in our actions. Our inner balance and even our very existence depend on it. Only morality in our actions can give beauty and dignity to life. To make this a living force and bring it to clear consciousness is perhaps the foremost task of education. The foundation of morality should not be made dependent on myth, nor tied to any authority, lest doubt about the myth or about the legitimacy of the authority imperil the foundation of sound judgment and action. Albert Einstein, Letter to a Minister, November 20, 1950, from Albert Einstein, The Human Side, page 95. A God who rewards and punishes is inconceivable to him for the simple reason that a man's actions are determined by necessity, external and internal, so that in God's eyes he cannot be responsible, any more than an inanimate object is responsible for the motions it undergoes. Science has therefore been charged with undermining morality, but the charge is unjust. A man's ethical behaviour should be based effectually on sympathy, education, and social ties and needs. No religious basis is necessary. Man would indeed be in a poor way if he had to be restrained by fear of punishment and hopes of reward after death. It is therefore easy to see why the churches have always fought science and persecuted its devotees. Albert Einstein, Religion and Science, in the New York Times Magazine, November 9, 1930, pages 3-4, from the expanded quotable Einstein, pages 205-206. The religious feeling engendered by experiencing the logical comprehensibility of profound interrelations is of a somewhat different sort from the feeling that one usually calls religious. It is more a feeling of awe at the scheme that is manifested in the material universe. It does not lead us to take the step of fashioning a godlike being in our own image, a personage who makes demands of us and who takes an interest in us as individuals. There is in this neither a will, nor a goal, nor a must, but only sheer being. For this reason, people of our type see in morality a purely human matter, albeit the most important in the human sphere. Albert Einstein, Letter to a Rabbi in Chicago, from Albert Einstein, The Human Side, pages 69-70. I have never imputed to nature a purpose or a goal or anything that could be understood as anthropomorphic. What I see in nature is a magnificent structure that we can comprehend only very imperfectly, and that must fill a thinking person with a feeling of humility. This is a genuinely religious feeling that has nothing to do with mysticism. Albert Einstein, replying to a letter in 1954 or 1955, from Albert Einstein, The Human Side, page 39. I do not believe that a man should be restrained in his daily actions by being afraid of punishment after death, or that he should do things only because in this way he will be rewarded after he dies. This does not make sense. The proper guidance during the life of a man should be the weight that he puts upon ethics and the amount of consideration that he has for others. Albert Einstein, from Peter A. Bucky, The Private Albert Einstein, Kansas City, Andrews and McMeel, 1992, page 86. Scientific research is based on the idea that everything that takes place is determined by laws of nature, and therefore this holds for the action of people. For this reason, a research scientist will hardly be inclined to believe that events could be influenced by a prayer, i.e., by a wish addressed to a supernatural being. Albert Einstein, in response to a child who had written him in 1936 and asked if scientists pray, from Albert Einstein, The Human Side, page 32. I cannot conceive of a personal God who would directly influence the actions of individuals, or would directly sit in judgment on creatures of his own creation. I cannot do this in spite of the fact that mechanistic causality has, to a certain extent, been placed in doubt by modern science. He was speaking of quantum mechanics and the breaking down of determinism. My religiosity consists in a humble admiration of the infinitely superior spirit that reveals itself in the little that we, with our weak and transitory understanding, can comprehend of reality. Morality is of the highest importance, but for us, not for God. Albert Einstein, from Albert Einstein, The Human Side, page 66. The finest emotion of which we are capable is the mystic emotion. Herein lies the germ of all art and all true science. Anyone to whom this feeling is alien, who is no longer capable of wonderment, and lives in a state of fear, is a dead man. To know that what is impenetrable for us really exists and manifests itself as the highest wisdom and the most radiant beauty, whose gross forms alone are intelligible to our poor faculties, this knowledge, this feeling, that is the core of the true religious sentiment. In this sense, and in this sense alone, I rank myself among profoundly religious men. The idea of a personal God is an anthropological concept which I am unable to take seriously. Albert Einstein, Letter to Hoffman and Dukas, 1946, from Albert Einstein, The Human Side. The further the spiritual evolution of mankind advances, the more certain it seems to me that the path to genuine religiosity does not lie through the fear of life, and the fear of death, and blind faith, but through striving after rational knowledge. Albert Einstein, Science, Philosophy, and Religion, a 1934 symposium, published by the Conference on Science, Philosophy, and Religion in Their Relation to the Democratic Way of Life, Inc., New York, 1941, from Einstein's Out of My Later Years, Westport, Connecticut, Greenwood Press, 1970, pages 29-30. I cannot believe that God plays dice with the cosmos. Albert Einstein on Quantum Mechanics, published in the London Observer, April 5, 1964, also quoted as, God does not play dice with the world, in Einstein, The Life and Times, Ronald W. Clark, New York, World Publishing Company, 1971, page 19. I cannot accept any concept of God based on the fear of life or the fear of death or blind faith. I cannot prove to you that there is no personal God, but if I were to speak of him, I would be a liar. Albert Einstein, from Einstein, The Life and Times, page 622. During the youthful period of mankind's spiritual evolution, human fantasy created gods in man's own image, who, by the operations of their will, were supposed to determine, or at any rate to influence, the phenomenal world. Man sought to alter the disposition of these gods in his own favor by means of magic and prayer. The idea of God in the religions taught at present is a sublimation of that old concept of the gods. Its anthropomorphic character is shown, for instance, by the fact that men appeal to the divine being in prayers and plead for the fulfillment of their wishes. Nobody certainly will deny that the idea of the existence of an omnipotent, just, and omnibeneficent personal God is able to accord man solace, help, and guidance. Also, by virtue of its simplicity, it is accessible to the most undeveloped mind. But on the other hand, there are decisive weaknesses attached to this idea in itself, which have been painfully felt since the beginning of history. That is, if this being is omnipotent, then every occurrence, including every human action, every human thought, and every human feeling and aspiration is also his work. How is it possible to think of holding men responsible for their deeds and thoughts before such an almighty being? In giving out punishment and rewards, he would, to a certain extent, be passing judgment on himself. How can this be combined with the goodness and righteousness ascribed to him? The main source of the present-day conflicts between the spheres of religion and of science lie in this concept of a personal God. It is the aim of science to establish general rules which determine the reciprocal connection of objects and events in time and space. For these rules, or laws of nature, absolutely general validity is required, not proven. It is mainly a program, and faith in the possibility of its accomplishment in principle is only founded on partial successes. But hardly anyone could be found who would deny these partial successes and ascribe them to human self-deception. The fact that on the basis of such laws we are able to predict the temporal behavior of phenomena in certain domains with great precision and certainty is deeply embedded in the consciousness of the modern man, even though he may have grasped very little of the contents of those laws. He need only consider that planetary courses within the solar system may be calculated in advance with great exactitude on the basis of a limited number of simple laws. In a similar way, though not with the same precision, it is possible to calculate in advance the mode of operation of an electric motor, a transmission system, or of a wireless apparatus, even when dealing with a novel development. To be sure, when the number of factors coming into play in a phenomenological complex is too large, scientific method in most cases fails us. One need only think of the weather, in which case prediction, even for a few days ahead, is impossible. Nevertheless, no one doubts that we are confronted with a causal connection whose causal components are in the main known to us. Occurrences in this domain are beyond the reach of exact prediction because of the variety of factors in operation, not because of any lack of order in nature. We have penetrated far less deeply into the regularities obtaining within the realm of living things, but deeply enough, nevertheless, to sense at least the rule of fixed necessity. One need only think of the systematic order in hereditary, and in the effect of poisons, as for instance, alcohol, on the behavior of organic beings. What is still lacking here is a grasp of connections of profound generality, but not a knowledge of order in itself. The more a man is imbued with the order of regularity of all events, the firmer becomes his conviction that there is no room left by the side of this ordered regularity for causes of a different nature. For him, neither the rule of human nor the rule of divine will exists as an independent cause of natural events. To be sure, the doctrine of a personal God interfering with natural events could never be refuted, in the real sense, by science. For this doctrine can always take refuge in those domains in which scientific knowledge has not yet been able to set foot. But I am persuaded that such behavior on the part of the representatives of religion would not only be unworthy, but also fatal. For a doctrine which is able to maintain itself not in clear light, but only in the dark, will of necessity lose its effect on mankind, with incalculable harm to human progress. In their struggle for the ethical good, teachers of religion must have the stature to give up the doctrine of a personal God, that is, give up that source of fear and hope which in the past placed such vast power in the hands of priests. In their labors, they will have to avail themselves of those forces which are capable of cultivating the good, the true, and the beautiful in humanity itself. This is, to be sure, a more difficult, but an incomparably more worthy task. Albert Einstein, Science, Philosophy, and Religion, from Einstein's Out of My Later Years, pages 26 to 29. I cannot then believe in this concept of an anthropomorphic God who has the powers of interfering with these natural laws. As I said before, the most beautiful and most profound religious emotion that we can experience is the sensation of the mystical. And this mysticality is the power of all true science. Albert Einstein, from Peter A. Buckey, The Private Albert Einstein, Kansas City, Andrews and McBeal, 1992, page 86. The mystical trend of our time, which shows itself particularly in the rampant growth of the so-called theosophy and spiritualism, is for me no more than a symptom of weakness and confusion, since our inner experiences consist of reproductions and combinations of sensory impressions. The concept of a soul without a body seems to me to be empty and devoid of meaning. Albert Einstein, in a letter, February 5, 1921, from Albert Einstein, The Human Side, page 40. Mere unbelief in a personal God is no philosophy at all. Albert Einstein, letter to V. T. Altonen, May 7, 1952. Einstein Archive, 59-059. From The Expanded Quotable Einstein, page 216. I have repeatedly said that in my opinion the idea of a personal God is a childlike one. You may call me an agnostic, but I do not share the crusading spirit of the professional atheist, whose fervor is mostly due to a painful act of liberation from the fetters of religious indoctrination received in youth. I prefer an attitude of humility corresponding to the weakness of our intellectual understanding of nature and of our own being. Albert Einstein, to Guy H. Ranner, Jr., September 28, 1949. From Michael R. Gilmore, Einstein's God, Just What Did Einstein Believe About God? Skeptic, 1997, 5-64. For science can only ascertain what is, but not what should be, and outside of its domain value judgments of all kinds remain necessary. Religion, on the other hand, deals only with evaluations of human thought and action. It cannot justifiably speak of facts and relationships between facts. Albert Einstein, Out of My Later Years, page 25. In view of such harmony in the cosmos, which I, with my limited human mind, am able to recognize, there are yet people who say there is no God. But what really makes me angry is that they quote me for the support of such views. Albert Einstein, according to the testimony of Prince Hubertus of Lowenstein, as quoted by Ronald W. Clark, Einstein, The Life and Times, page 425. I received your letter of June 10th. I have never talked to a Jesuit priest in my life, and I am astonished by the audacity to tell such lies about me. From the viewpoint of a Jesuit priest, I am, of course, and have always been, an atheist. Your counter-arguments seem to me very correct and could hardly be better formulated. It is always misleading to use anthropomorphical concepts in dealing with things outside the human sphere. Childish analogies. We have to admire, in humility, the beautiful harmony of the structure of this world as far as we can grasp it. And that is all. Albert Einstein, to Guy H. Ranner, Jr., July 2, 1945. Responding to a rumor that a Jesuit priest had caused Einstein to convert from atheism. From Michael R. Gilmore, Einstein's God. Just what did Einstein believe about God? Skeptic, 1997, 5-62. I am convinced that some political and social activities and practices of the Catholic organizations are detrimental and even dangerous for the community as a whole, here and everywhere. I mention here only the fight against birth control at a time when overpopulation in various countries has become a serious threat to the health of people and a grave obstacle to any attempt to organize peace on this planet. Albert Einstein, in a letter, 1954, from Paul Blanchard, American Freedom and Catholic Power, New Jersey, Greenwood Publishing, 1984, page 10. His, Einstein, was not a life of prayer and worship, yet he lived by a deep faith, a faith not capable of rational foundation. That there are laws of nature to be discovered, his lifelong pursuit was to discover them. His realism and his optimism are illuminated by his remark, "Subtle is the Lord, but malicious he is not. Raffineret ist der Ergott, aber Botschaft ist er nicht." When asked by a colleague what he meant by that, he replied, "Nature hides her secret because of her essential loftiness, but not by means of ruse. Die Natur verbirgt ich Germenes durch die Erhabenheit ihres Wesens, aber nicht durch List." Abraham Pais. Subtle is the Lord, the science and the life of Albert Einstein. Oxford University Press, New York, 1982. However, Einstein's God was not the God of most other men. When he wrote of religion, as he often did in middle and later life, he tended to adopt the belief of Alice's Red Queen, that words mean what you want them to mean, and to clothe with different names what, to more ordinary mortals, and to most Jews, looked like a variant of simple agnosticism. Replying in 1929 to a cabled inquiry from Rabbi Goldstein of New York, he said that he believed in Spinoza's God, who reveals himself in the harmony of all that exists, not in a God who concerns himself with the fate and actions of men. And it is claimed that years later, asked by Ben-Gurion whether he believed in God, even he, with his great formula about energy and mass, agreed that there must be something behind the energy. No doubt. But much of Einstein's writing gives the impression of belief in a God, even more intangible and impersonal than a celestial machine minder, running the universe with indisputable authority and expert touch. Instead, Einstein's God appears as the physical world itself, with its infinitely marvelous structure operating at atomic level with the beauty of a craftsman's wristwatch, and at stellar level with the majesty of a massive cyclotron. This was belief enough. It grew early and rooted deep. Only later was it dignified by the title of cosmic religion, a phrase which gave plausible respectability to the views of a man who did not believe in a life after death, and who felt that if virtue paid off in the earthly one, then this was the result of cause and effect, rather than celestial reward. Einstein's God thus stood for an orderly system obeying rules which could be discovered by those who had the courage, imagination, and persistence to go on searching for them. It was to this past which he began to turn his mind, soon after the age of 12. The rest of his life, everything else was to seem almost trivial by comparison. Ronald W. Clark, Einstein, The Life and Times, New York, World Publishing, 1971, pages 19 to 20. That a man can take pleasure in marching, in formation, to the strains of a band is enough to make me despise him. He has only been given his big brain by mistake. A backbone was all he needed. This plague spot of civilization ought to be abolished with all possible speed. 100 times every day I remind myself that my inner and outer life depend on the labors of other men, living and dead, and that I must exert myself in order to give in the measure as I have received and am still receiving. Albert Einstein.